You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. The time now is around 6:30, and the next it's time for another episode of Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness. This is episode 67. I'd like to welcome you to this show. My name is Dr. Mike. I'm an MD and a naturopath and a teacher of meditation for a good number of years. I have another program on this radio. It's called The Awakening of the Self. It's more of a spiritual program, how to awaken your spiritual consciousness. But this program, Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness, is about giving you good knowledge to preserve and restore your health if you happen to have fallen ill and you're not enjoying the 100% vigor of good health. This is a show for you. You can gradually learn what is good food, what is good lifestyle, and how to restore your health. In the long run, we also have another goal, and that is right now the drug companies have so much money, they've bought the hearts and souls of the medical doctors, and also they pretty much own the curriculum for the doctors when they go to medical school, and they also pretty much own the medical journals, and we have that doctor, I've forgotten her name now, who is editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, coming out explaining how the drug companies have bought the taken over the magazines, the medical magazines, and are able to get their own viewpoint and articles in there. Anyway, it's not that I'm completely against drugs, but there should not be the first line of defense, and they should not be the last line of defense. They're okay for a short period of time to get you back into a better vibration. But then other natural things that have been used for thousands of years should eventually take over. And then you don't have the poisoning of the body by these chemicals. You can call into this program at any time. The number is 831-427-3772. It's good to have a pencil so you can jot down the things that come up in this program. I'll call out the number again in a few minutes if you go and get a pen and get a paper or something to write on. We also have an email here, but I haven't started using the email yet. The slogan for this program is we'd like people to gradually make a move from a animal-based diet to a whole plant-based diet because a lot of the illnesses we have today are contributed a lot by animal products. And some of those things include, and I'm talking now the science of behind all this. There's lots of science to validate these points I'm going to make. Is that meat causes an increase in what's called glucose factor 1, and that stimulates the growth of cancer cells in your body. Cancer is spontaneously being produced every day, and these cells have to be killed by the immune system. But if you have high glucose factor 1 levels, then you're promoting these cancer cells. In fact, the difference between a vegetarian diet and an animal-based diet is vegetarian people have 18 times less of the level of glucose factor 1 in the bloodstream. Also, it contributes to cholesterol and heart problems and blockages of arteries, as we know. Also, it's not the only thing involved in that, because inflammation is involved in that, but meat and dairy and eggs all contribute to inflammation in the body by promoting what's called arachidonic acid pathway to inflammation. So inflammation is behind all the diseases that we have here prevalent in the Western world. So you'd be well advised to eat a non-inflammatory diet. And it's good. It'll be good for you to get the test called C-reactive protein done when you go to your doctor next. C-reactive protein. And also the fat that comes with, the saturated fat that comes with animal products, it gives rise to insulin resistance, which gives rise to diabetes. So be aware. It's not a good idea to eat a lot of meat. And it's a good idea to gradually wean yourself off meat and start moving over to the other side, towards the vegetarian and towards the vegan lifestyle, and see how far you can get. You know, you're going to have to learn how to cook interesting dishes, and you're going to. It's a process, but let it take as much time as you need. But start the process. Start moving in that direction. If you take my advice, you may decide not to, but that's fine with me, but pay the consequences. Okay, the phone number here is 831-427-3772. And I think that's about it for the moment. So I suppose we could play a little music, brighten up the air a little bit. And this one will be... Luciano Pavarotti singing Nosam Dorma. Nella tua fredda stanza Okay, that was Pavarotti, Luciano Pavarotti singing Nosam Dorma. It's a well-known song in the kind of opera circuit. Anyway, the man passed away a few years ago, but his music is still great. So now that you've heard some good music, it's time to get some good information in under your belt. The next speaker is going to be Caldwell Esselstyn. That's E-S-S-E-L-S-T-I-N, Esselstyn. And he's a cardiologist or a heart specialist, and Worked in the, I believe, the Mayo Clinic, yes, for a good number of years, maybe still even working there. But he wrote a book, and he did some experiments on reversing heart problems. So he's pretty much an expert in that area. So we should basically listen to what he has to say if we want, number one, not to go down that road and develop heart disease and all the other consequences that come with it. And number two, if we want to prevent heart disease, not just cure it. That's the title of his book. It's, I believe it's called Preventing and Curing Heart Disease. So this will be good information for you to absorb.
Coronary artery disease is the leading killer of women and men in Western civilization. And yet, the truth be known, it is nothing more than a toothless paper tiger that need never exist. And if it does exist, it need never ever progress. This is a foodborne illness. Well, my story begins actually in the late 1970s, early 80s, when I was chairman of the breast cancer task force at the Cleveland Clinic. And my frustration was that no matter for how many women I was doing breast surgery, I was doing nothing for the next unsuspecting victim. And this led to sort of a bit of global research. And it was quite striking to find that breast cancer rates in Kenya were something like 30 or 40 times less frequent in the United States. And if you looked at breast cancer rates in rural Japan in the 1950s, it was very infrequently identified. And yet, as soon as the Japanese women would migrate to the United States, by the second and third generation, they now had the same rate of breast cancer as their Caucasian counterpart. But even more powerful, perhaps, was the data on cancer of the prostate. In 1958, in the entire nation of Japan, how many autopsy-proven deaths were there from cancer of the prostate? 18. That's the most mind-boggling public health figure I think I've ever heard. But I made a decision then that I was concerned that my bones would long be dust before I could really get answers between nutrition and cancer. And so I chose to deal with cardiovascular disease, which is the leading killer of women and men in Western civilization. And it was quite striking that in this global review, there were a number of cultures by heritage and tradition that simply lacked any cardiovascular disease. They were plant-based. And so with that information, I came back to Cleveland, and when my wife and I decided to go on this plant-based diet for a year, and then I asked cardiology if I could have about 24 patients, which was the number that I could handle, and still carry out my surgical obligations. And the 24 patients that I received were, as my late brother-in-law used to say, the walking dead. But they were most cooperative, and it was within about, say, 15 months of starting this program that we had something striking develop. I was treating a 52-year-old gentleman who, in addition to his heart disease, had a partially blocked artery in his right thigh. And he told me about the fact that when he was crossing the skyway to my office, he had to stop five times because of pain in his calf, because of this blocked artery. So I had him go to the vascular lab, and we got his pulse volume. And then I forgot all about his leg, so focused on his heart. And 8 months later, he said, "Dr. Esselstyn, you recall when I first started seeing you, I had to stop five times crossing the skyway to your office. This last month, it got to be four times, then it was three, two, one." He said, "I don't stop anymore. The pain is gone. Don, back you go to the vascular lab." I think if you look here, you can see the difference in pulse volume when I first saw him. And here we were 8 months later. It was now almost two times greater. So the thing that was so exciting about this was, in science, we had
demonstrated. This is taken by a video, so you can't see, unfortunately.
Not only that, but this occurred 1 year before the invention of the statin drugs. So this was so powerful because it showed us that indeed with nutrition, we could actually not only halt this disease, but we could reverse it. And not shortly thereafter, what occurred, we saw this now in the heart. This is a 54-year-old security guard where our angiography core laboratory described this as a 30% improvement. But what really got our attention was a fellow surgeon at the clinic who, at age 44 in 1996, began to get chest pain. He did not have hypertension, he did not have diabetes, he did not have a strong family history, he was not overweight. And cardiology worked him up in October of 1996, could find nothing. 3 weeks later, he was finishing his surgical schedule, sat down to write postoperative orders, splitting headache, immediately followed by this crushing elephant on his chest, pain in his shoulder down his arm. Joe was having a heart attack. Whipped down to the cath lab, start the catheterization, cardiac arrest, resuscitate, and finish the catheterization. And then he's been sent up to the floors and discharged 3 days later, but very depressed. Why? Because what they identified was that his left anterior descending coronary artery in the front of the heart, the entire lower third was moth-eaten and diseased, over too long a segment to have stents, too far down the artery to have a bypass. So he was very depressed about this, so my wife Ann and I had him out to the house with his wife for supper 2 weeks after his heart attack. Joe, he'd been eating his typical Western diet. He got the typical Western disease. We've got 10 years of data. How about going plant-based? Okay, yes, I'll give it a shot. They couldn't offer me anything else. He became the absolute personification of commitment to plant-based nutrition. And over the next 30 months, he then had another angiogram. Now, up in the surgical suites, our offices are 3 doors apart. And at noontime of the day that I knew earlier that morning he had his follow-up angiogram, I found myself letting myself into his office. There he was sitting behind his desk. Joe, I understand you had the old follow-up angiogram this morning. Mind sharing with me how did it go? Got up around his desk, put his arms around me. I think we're doing okay. Well, any chance I could see the follow-up angiogram? Yeah. So it was really quite striking and exciting to see what actually can happen when you give the body every opportunity it can. The healing capacity is incredible. So now let's talk a little bit about how do you injure the artery in the first place? What seems to be going wrong? Now, on the right, there's a seriously diseased artery. And you're probably saying that's going to have a heart attack. No, that only causes about 10% of heart attacks, but it certainly will cause chest pain and shortness of breath. What I really want you to notice is on the left. And here, on the inside of this artery, there's this very, very tiny little dark single layer of cell magic carpet that all experts would agree is where the inception of this disease occurs. This magic carpet is called the endothelium. And the endothelium has an absolutely magic molecule that it produces. It's a gas, nitric oxide. Nitric oxide has a number of wonderful functions. Nitric oxide keeps our blood flowing smoothly like Teflon rather than Velcro. Two, nitric oxide is the strongest vasodilator in the body. When you climb stairs, the arteries to your heart dilate. The arteries to your legs dilate. Nitric oxide inhibits inflammation from the wall of the artery, protects you from getting hypertension. And most importantly, nitric oxide in plentiful amounts will protect you from ever developing blockages or plaque. All right. How do those 90% of heart attacks occur? You will see here the artery is divided. And what you're looking at in the first series on the left is that when you start eating that cheeseburger, the pizza, the milkshake, your blood flow gets sticky. And certain elements like your endothelial cells get sticky. Your LDL cholesterol gets sticky. And then the LDL bad cholesterol migrates into the subendothelial space, where it sets up this absolute cauldron of inflammation. And that cauldron of inflammation begins making inflammatory enzymes that gradually begin to thin out this delicate cap over the plaque. Gets thinner and thinner until it's as thin as a cobweb. And then the sheer force of blood, phew, going over that thinned out plaque ruptures. And now we have spillage of plaque content into the flowing blood, which activates our platelets, our clotting factor. And now we have the beginning of a clot, a thrombosis, which is in and of itself self-propagating. So in a matter of minutes, now we have an artery that is totally blocked, and all the downstream heart muscle has been deprived of oxygen and nutrients, starts to die, and that's the heart attack. But there is something absolutely magically exciting about this series, because if I can convince you that all you have to do is change your nutrition so your internal biochemistry is such that you will not injure or thin out the cap over your plaque, you will actually diminish your plaque and you will strengthen the cap over the plaque. All right. How do we do this? It's very easy. We avoid the foods that injure the endothelium. What are they? Even pure virgin olive oil, corn oil, soybean oil, safflower oil, sunflower oil, coconut oil, palm oil, dairy, anything with a mother or a face, meat, fish. Meat, fish, chicken, and turkey, and also caffeine in coffee, and fructose. All right, what are you going to eat? All those marvelous whole grains for your cereal, bread, and pasta. 101 different types of legumes. Vegetables, which are red, yellow, and green leafy, and fruit. But especially the green leafy vegetables are like water on the fire. What green leafy vegetables? Bok choy, Swiss chard, kale, collards, collard green, beet greens, mustard green, green beans, lapa cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower, cilantro, parsley, spinach, and arugula, and I'm out of breath. But remember, no oil. Now, conventional cardiology, with all those procedures and all that expense, there's high mortality, high morbidity, and sadly, it does not cure the disease, and the expense is unsustainable. However, when you're treating causality with plant-based nutrition, no mortality with the diet, no morbidity with the diet, and what happens with the passage of time, the benefits just continue to improve. And lastly, nobody has greater fear of another heart attack than somebody who's already had a heart attack. And how empowering it can be for them and their family to know that they themselves can now become the locus of control for this disease, destroying it, whereas in the past it had been trying to destroy them. And that, lastly, I want to just share with you, this isn't just that original early study. We're about to publish another 200 patients. And the reason we have 91% compliance is because we have a very strong, intense, single, five-hour counseling seminar. And that's the same amount of time the cardiac surgeon has, but I have the patient when they're awake. So, how do we do? If we look at the vertical axis, what you're seeing here is the average of about three independent cohorts of cardiology studies that are quite well known. And the recurrent cardiac events after 4 years run about 20% on average. Our own, which is called treating the cause, is a half of 1%. That means roughly a 40-fold difference. So in summary, it is really so exciting what happens when you treat the causation of disease, because it is not only prompt, it is powerful, and it is persistent. And for those who in the future are coming down with cardiovascular disease, I hope it is going to be unconscionable not to inform them of the power of this option. from which they can thrive. Thank you.
Okay, that was Dr. Caldwell Estelstein. All right, and he's written a book. I believe the title of the book is Prevention of Heart and Cure, something like that. But if you remember his name, you'll find his book pretty easily. It's a well-known book throughout the general readers of health books. And so it'll be well worth your while to get your hands on the book. I've read it myself in the past. I'm not sure where my copy is, but it's somewhere around. Anyway, let's see now. So we got about, we got till 7:30. So I have a number of little short clips for you to play that you can learn something about various aspects of health. So we'll play the first one right now.
A wild ride. One of the fundamental gospels of sports physiology just got turned on its head. Every exercise physiology textbook in the world just got thrown out the window, and all because of beet juice. When athletes train, the reason they get better is they improve oxygen delivery to their muscles. Changes in their lungs allow them to take bigger breaths, for example. Strengthening of the heart boosts cardiac output and blood flow. Your body may even start making more red blood cells to boost the oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood. But the energy ultimately derived from that oxygen remains the same. X amount of oxygen gets you X amount of work, period, no matter who you are. As an analogy, on the same gasoline, a Lamborghini goes faster than some lemon, but not because the chemistry of gasoline combustion is different in the sports car, it's just a more powerful engine. Similarly, we may have bigger muscles, we may be able to get more oxygen to those muscles quicker, but the fundamental energy that can be extracted from oxygen remains the same. Or so we thought. Researchers put 8 guys on bikes and measured their oxygen consumption before and after a few days sipping 2 cups of beet juice. Before this series of experiments, there was no known drug, substance, steroid, intervention, nothing that could actually increase energy extraction from oxygen. Yet, this is what they found. The open ovals are the placebo, and the filled are the beetroot group. After a couple cups of beet juice, they could do the exact same amount of work with less oxygen. Same work with 19% less oxygen. Then when they ramped up the bike for an intense bout of what they called severe cycling, time to exhaustion was extended from 9 minutes 43 seconds to 11 minutes 15. Greater endurance with less oxygen in the beet group. 16% improvement in their time with only about 4/5 the oxygen requirement. In short, the beet juice made their body's energy production significantly more efficient.
Okay, that's a good thing to know about. So if you want to become more efficient with your oxygen, drink beet juice every day. It sounds like 2 cups.
According to this study, by far the most comprehensive of its kind in history, there are only 3 whole foods on the planet that have more antioxidant power than cloves, and one of them is amla, dried Indian gooseberries. Now, not only is it more powerful, but also more palatable. You could add a whole teaspoon of amla to a smoothie and probably wouldn't even taste it. Try doing that with a teaspoon of powdered cloves. One sip, you'd be on the floor. Let's look at the antioxidant content of some typical American breakfast foods. Bacon and eggs, for example. A bowl of cornflakes with milk. Egg McMuffin, pancakes with maple syrup, bagel with cream cheese. Now compare those to the smoothie I had this morning. Cup of unsweetened soy milk, a half a cup of frozen blueberries. Whoa! Right, already I've got a shrink the scale way down. The pulp of a nice ripe Mexican mango. Note, the mango alone has more antioxidants than the other breakfasts. Right? A tablespoon of ground flax seeds, and my previous secret ingredient, a palmful of bulk white tea leaves. Just throw them in there and blend them in. Now, that used to be my breakfast smoothie, but now, a teaspoon of that gooseberry powder, and we're off the charts again. Right, look at that. That's about 4 cents worth of omelet, 4 pennies, and look what it does to my smoothie. 1,500 units of antioxidant power, and I haven't even fully woken up yet. Way more than the 5 other meals combined. In fact, more than the average person gets in an entire week. Right? I could drink my smoothie and eat nothing but donuts the rest of the week, and most people still wouldn't catch up. Notice, though, that even though I packed the blender with amazing stuff, blueberries, tea leaves, fully half of the antioxidant power came from that single teaspoon, that 4 cents worth of powdered gooseberries.
Just note there, amla, AMLA, it's otherwise called Indian gooseberry. It's very high in antioxidants, so I'm not sure where he buys it for 4 cents, but you can definitely get it in the health food store. But I'm sure Indian stores would have it even at a cheaper rate. So his breakfast was hundreds of times higher, I think 1,500. OCA or something. It's the measurement for the antioxidants. It was a lot higher than the normal breakfast that people eat. So he made a smoothie from that. He had the things I remember. He had blackberries, blueberries. He had some fruit. I think it was. Forgot now. It was a peach or something, and then he had amla in there. So he had a really high breakfast in high-end antioxidants, and that's what I would recommend for everybody, including myself, to start the day well. Is just go for the antioxidants that your body needs. Okay, let's see what the next piece is.
Every day we should stuff our faces with fruits and vegetables, but which are the healthiest? In my 1999 review, I ranked blueberries as the healthiest fruits and kale the healthiest vegetable, based on a study of 40 common fruits and veggies at the time. But then in 2002, this article was published looking at 200 different plants, and I told audiences that blueberries got their little blue butts kicked down to number 7. No one had tested nuts before, the new reigning antioxidant champs, with pomegranates nipping at their heels. But then, this study was published in 2003, looking at herbs and spices, and I had to revise yet again, saying the healthiest food by weight, at least on this planet, is not blueberries, not kale, not nuts, but cloves and oregano. 40 times the antioxidant power of blueberries on a weight-by-weight basis, and about 1,000 times more than what most Americans eat. And the graph for cloves at this scale is far, far off the chart. Now, but this was all 5 years ago, though. What about goji berries and all these exotic new fruits on the market? Well, the biggest study of its kind was published last year, looking at 300 plant foods. Once again, cloves number one. Found to be the most antioxidant-packed food substance on the planet. But this is on a weight-by-weight basis. You can eat a whole handful of nuts, no problem, but a handful of cloves? So, on a per-serving basis, nuts actually have more antioxidants than cloves, since the serving size of nuts is like an ounce, and the serving size of cloves is just a tiny pinch. So allow me to rank the top dozen anti-aging, anti-cancer, antioxidant superfoods based on the latest findings by serving to make it more practical in terms of helping you find ways to eat healthier on a day-to-day basis. Now, there are sweeteners that do have some nutrition. This new article in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association measured the antioxidant content of a whole list. Which is healthier? In alphabetical order, agave nectar, blackstrap molasses, brown rice syrup, corn syrup, date sugar, dark brown sugar, light brown sugar, maple syrup, honey, raw cane sugar, plain old sugar, or turbinado sugar. Here's the graph. Two actually have some significant nutrition, but the rest are pretty much a wash. Let's start filling this in. Should we start with an easy one to launch us off? Table sugar versus raw, pure, organic agave nectar. Which is worse? Does sugar have less nutrition, or does agave nectar have less nutrition, or do they both have the same? Remember how I asked if we should start out with an easy one? Well, I guess the answer is no. They both have exactly the same nutrition, which is to say, basically none. Sugar is here, agave is here, each with a completely pitiful 2/1,000,000th of a mole of plasma ferric acid reducing ability, which is essentially zero antioxidant power. There's one sweetener with even less, though. Now, all those down at that end are basically just empty calories, but out of curiosity, which has even less nutrition than sugar? 10 left to choose from. Which one was all the way down at the end? Least nutrition. Now, we knew corn syrup was here, remember, same as sugar. They're all empty calories, but brown rice syrup measured out as the emptiest. Which is worse, honey or maple syrup, or the same? Well, they can't be the same, right? I mean, there aren't two bars left the same size. Both still sugar, but honey beats out maple syrup. In fact, all these are basically just sugar, whether dark, light, raw, or turbinado. There are only two health-promoting sweeteners, only two sweeteners that are actually good for you: molasses and date sugar. They're both good, but out of curiosity, which one falls to second place? Do you think molasses is less healthy than date sugar, or does date sugar fall to second place? The healthiest sweetener on the planet is date sugar. Date sugar is not really sugar, it's just whole dried dates pulverized into powder. As the only whole food up there, no wonder it's number one. It's the only thing I ever use in baking. Because it's a whole plant food, it has fiber, though, so there is a thickening effect, which is great for smoothies or hot chocolate. But what if you want to sweeten your tea or coffee? You don't exactly want thick tea. Now, you could add sugar, but then you're adding empty calories, and if you drink as much tea as you really should, that can add up.
Okay, you have it there, date sugar and molasses.
The jury is finally in on stevia. The reason it's been such a long time coming is that research out of Japan in the 90s found that steviacides, the active ingredient in stevia, appeared totally harmless. But in the guts of rats, intestinal bacteria transformed steviacides into something called steviol, which is toxic, causing a big spike in mutagenic DNA damage. So the question was, do we have those same rat bacteria in our guts? And it turns out we do. So we know that when we eat stevia, mutagenic compounds are produced in our colons and absorbed into our bloodstream. The only remaining question was, how much? The World Health Organization just released their latest evaluation of food additives, and they consider up to 4 milligrams per kilogram of body weight safe. So that's 1.8 milligrams per pound. So if you multiply your weight in pounds times 1.8, that's how many milligrams of stevia compounds you should stay under. The problem is the American sweet tooth. We're supposed to stay under 4, but if we sweetened everything with stevia, we could exceed that safety limit, at least in the United States. But as long as you only drink like 2 stevia-sweetened beverages a day, it can be considered harmless.
Okay, there's the recent decision about stevia. And so don't take too much.
What's the latest on spirulina supplements? The reason I told everyone to throw their spirulina away was that it was found to produce hepatotoxins. While blue-green algae supplements had the brain toxins, spirulina supplements were found to have liver toxins. Should we continue to avoid this stuff? Yes. Now, spirulina can boast neurotoxins as well. In 2009, a potent neurotoxin was found in spirulina supplements for the first time.
Say a lot of people take spirulina believing it's good for them, but science says different. Okay, beware. We're just waiting on the
what
next
about
clip.
The microscopic greens like spirulina? Of all the controversial findings I've shared from the medical literature over the years, this is the one I get the most mail about. People love their pond scum. So I've stayed on top of the literature, and it's time for an update. There's no doubt that spirulina does some amazing things, but as with everything in life, it's all about risk-benefit. And so, although in 2007 the data pointed against spirulina, and I threw mine out and encouraged others to do the same, is it possible that the balance of evidence has shifted back in favor? Still harmful, half and half, or crept back to helpful? In 2007 I was concerned about spirulina because of muscle breakdown, and these new findings have me concerned about liver cancer, too. 94% of samples were found to be contaminated with hepatotoxic microcystin toxins.
That's 94% of spirulina samples taken.
If the fructose in sugar and high fructose corn syrup has been considered alcohol without the buzz in terms of its potential to inflict liver damage, what about the source of natural fructose, fruit? Only industrial, not fruit fructose intake was associated with declining liver function. Same thing with high blood pressure. Fructose from added sugars was associated with hypertension, but fructose from natural fruits is not. If you compare the effects of a diet restricting fructose from both added sugars and fruit to one just restricting fructose from added sugars, the diet that kept the fruit did better. People lost more weight with the extra fruit present than if all fructose was restricted across the board. The deleterious effect of fructose was limited to industrial fructose, meaning table sugar and high fructose corn syrup, with no evidence for a negative effect of the fructose in whole fruit. This apparent inconsistency might be explained by the positive effects of other nutrients, like fiber and antioxidants, in fresh fruit. Well, let's find out. If you have people drink a glass of water with 3 tablespoons of table sugar in it, which is like a can of soda, this is the big spike in blood sugar you get within the first half hour. Our body freaks out and releases so much insulin to drive down this spike, we actually overshoot, and 90 minutes in, we're relatively hypoglycemic, dropping our blood sugar below where it was before we drank the sugar. In response, our body dumps fat into our bloodstream as if we're starving. Because our blood sugars just drop so suddenly below fasting levels, our body got worried. Now, what if you add blended berries in addition to the sugar, like a berry smoothie? Now, they have sugars of their own. In fact, in this experiment, an additional tablespoon of sugar's worth. So the blood sugar spike should be worse, right? No. Not only was there no additional blood sugar spike, here's the critical part. No hypoglycemic dip afterwards. Blood sugar just went up and down without that overshoot and without the surge of fat into our blood. This difference was attributed to the semi-solid consistency of the berry meals, which may have decreased the rate of stomach emptying compared to just guzzling sugar water. In addition, the soluble fiber in the berries has that kind of a gelling effect in the intestines that slows the release of sugars. To see if it was just the fiber, they repeated the experiment with berry juice that had all the sugar but none of the fiber. Now, as you can see, it's a kind of a clear difference observed early on in the blood sugar responses. At the 15-minute mark, the blood sugar spike was significantly reduced by the berry meals, but not by the juices. But the rest of the beneficial response, right, like at 90 minutes, were almost the same between the juice and the whole fruit, suggesting that fiber may just be part of it. It turns out there are fruit phytonutrients that inhibit the transportation of sugars through the intestinal wall into our bloodstream. Phytonutrients in foods like apples and strawberries can block some of the uptake of sugars by the cells lining our intestines. So adding berries can actually blunt the insulin spike from high glycemic foods. Here's what white bread does to our insulin levels within 2 hours after eating it. Now eat that same white bread with some berries, though, and you're able to blunt the spike. So even though you've effectively added more sugars in the form of berries, there's less of an insulin spike, which has a variety of potential short and long-term benefits. So if you're gonna make pancakes, make sure they're blueberry pancakes.
Yeah, that's another plus for berries. So if you're eating a sugary meal, eat berries as well. That'll keep your sugar down.
Now, there are sweeteners that do have some nutrition. This new article in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association measured the antioxidant content of a whole list. Which is healthier? In alphabetical order, agave nectar, blackstrap molasses, brown rice syrup, corn syrup, date sugar, dark brown sugar, light brown sugar.
Okay, we had that one before. Somehow or other, I'm not quite sure where we are now in these clips. Let me see if I can pick up the trend here. Is stevia good for you? We've had that one. Let me see. I'm getting close to where we update us for the fructose. Oh yeah. Sweetener. I must have had that one in there twice by mistake. Stevie, good for you. All right, let me see. How is the time doing? Oh, we've got... We do have another while. So I think what we're going to do is just move over here to another site. Just hang in there with me for a minute. I just didn't seem to have enough stuff packed on there to fill the whole hour. All right, we'll start here. Start here on this one. It's about reducing inflammation.
There's lots of products that promise to boost our immune system. And who wouldn't want that? Well, there's millions of people with autoimmune diseases, inflammatory diseases, and allergies, right? Millions of people whose immune systems may already be a bit too active. I try to make sufferers of seasonal allergies feel better by explaining that having an overactive immune system is not all bad. Individuals with allergies have a decreased risk for cancer compared with the general population. Yes, your immune system may be in such overdrive it's attacking things left and right like tree pollen, but that heightened state of alert might also help bring down some budding tumors in the body. So it's tricky. We want to boost the part of the immune system that fights infection while downregulating the part that results in chronic inflammation. And mushrooms may fit the bill. There are thousands of edible mushrooms, though only about 100 are cultivated commercially. Only 10 of those really on an industrial scale, and I do mean industrial, rising to over 20 million tons, and for good reason. They accelerate immunoglobulin A secretion. Let me explain. Though skin is considered our largest organ, we actually interface with the outside world more through our mucous membranes that line our mouth, our entire digestive tract, our reproductive and urinary systems, inside the breast glands, on our eyeballs, occupying our largest body surface area. Our gut alone covers more area than a tennis court, and much of it is only one cell thick. One microscopic layer is all that separates us from all the toxins, viruses, and bacteria out there, and so we need one heck of a first-line defense. And that defense is called IgA, immunoglobulin A. Immunoglobulin means antibody. These are our type A antibodies. Dietary intake may improve mucosal immunity by accelerating IgA secretion, but no studies have ever been conducted on mushrooms until now. So they had half people eat their normal diet, half eat their normal diet plus cooked white button mushrooms every day for a week. Then, using the passive dribble method for collecting saliva, they just measured the amount of IgA they were pumping out. No change in the control group. But after a week of mushrooms, IgA secretion jumped 50% and even stayed up there for a week after they stopped eating the mushrooms. This study has shown, for the first time, that dietary intake of white button mushrooms, just regular white mushrooms, about a cup a day, resulted in higher IgA secretion. And the elevated secretion remained stable into week two, but then fell back to baseline. So this suggests that in arresting or slowing the decrease in IgA in individuals such as the elderly or those with immune compromise, a continuous daily intake of mushrooms may be necessary to maintain an increased IgA secretion, meaning you can't just eat mushrooms once and expect to be protected forever. You have to make them part of your regular diet. But if you continue to churn out 50% more antibodies, might that contribute to chronic inflammation, which is implicated in the development of a variety of diseases? No. In fact, mushrooms appear to have an anti-inflammatory capacity in vitro, suggesting that they could be regarded as a potential source of natural anti-inflammatory agents. For example, here's an inflammatory response without mushrooms and with mushrooms, right? Both white and a few other varieties. They think it might be the phytonutrient pyrogallol, found in a variety of mushrooms, as well as in our old friend AMLA, Indian gooseberries that similarly appear to reduce inflammation while at the same time boosting immune and anti-cancer function.
Be good treatment for people if they're, instead of the flu vaccine, which has side effects I'll talk about later, to boost their immune system and keep it up. Garlic also helps to do that too, and among other things. Let's see, are we oh yeah, something coming up right now in the next one.
Do you know your risk factors for atherosclerosis? It's a leading killer of America.
That was an ad that came up, so I'm just waiting for the next tip.
This 31-year-old mom thought her back pain was a pull muscle until she saw this.
One out of two women are going to die of heart disease.
I knew immediately. My blood just ran cold. We left for the emergency room after the show was over.
Take care of your heart.
Okay, I've already played that bit. That's about heart disease. We played it last week or the week before. Okay, I have to scan down here. I think we're actually getting close to the end of the show right now. So we might be have time for another one or two. Okay, we got one coming up. It's basically about diverticulosis. It's a fairly common condition.
Diverticula are outpouchings from our intestine. Doctors like using a tire analogy. High pressures within the gut can force the intestines to balloon out through weak spots in the intestinal wall, like an inner tube poking out through a worn tire tread. This is what they actually look like. These pockets can become inflamed and infected, and to carry the tire analogy further, can blow out, spilling fecal matter into the abdomen or the bladder and lead to death. Symptoms can range from no symptoms at all, to a little cramping and bloating, to incapacitating pain that is a medical emergency. 9 out of 10 people that die from the disease never even knew they had it. But the good news is that there may be a way to prevent the disease. Diverticular disease is the most common intestinal disorder, affecting up to 70% of people by age 60. If it's that common, though, maybe it's just an inevitable consequence of aging? No, it's a new disease. In 1907, 25 cases had been reported in the medical literature. Not in 25% of people, but 25 cases, period. And they're kind of hard to miss on autopsy. 100 years ago, in 1916, it didn't even merit mention in medical and surgical textbooks. The mystery wasn't solved until 1971. How did a disease that was almost unknown become the most common affliction of the colon in the Western world within one lifespan? Surgeons Painter and Burkitt suggested diverticulosis was a deficiency disease, a disease caused by a deficiency of fiber. In the late 1800s, roller milling was introduced, further removing fiber from grain, and we started to fill up on fiber-deficient foods like meat and sugar. A few decades of this, and diverticulosis was rampant. This is what they thought was going on. Just as it would be easy to squeeze a lump of butter through a bicycle tube, it's easy to move large, soft, moist intestinal contents through the gut. In contrast, try squeezing through a lump of tar. See, when we eat fiber-deficient diets, our feces can become small and firm, and so our intestines really have to squeeze down hard to move it along. And this buildup of pressure may force out those bulges. And eventually, A low-fiber diet can then sometimes lead to the colon literally rupturing itself. If this theory is true, then populations that eat high-fiber diets would have low rates of diverticulosis, and that's what's been found. More than 50% of African Americans in their 50s were found to have diverticulosis, compared to less than 1% in African Africans eating traditional plant-based diets. And by less than 1%, we're talking 0 out of a series of 2,000 autopsies, 2 out of 4,000 in Uganda. That's like 1,000 times lower prevalence. What then about this newer study, concluding that a low-fiber diet was not associated with diverticulosis? We'll cover that next. By our 70s, one in five of us will suffer from cognitive impairment, and within 5 years, half will progress to dementia, in a progression from cognitive impairment without dementia to dementia and death. The earlier we can slow or stop this process, the better. Although an effective treatment for Alzheimer's disease is unavailable, even interventions just to control risk factors could prevent millions of cases. So an immense effort has been spent on identifying risk factors for Alzheimer's and developing treatments to reduce them. In 1990, a small study of 22 Alzheimer's patients reported that they had high concentrations of something called homocysteine in their blood. The homocysteine story starts back in 1969, when a Harvard pathologist reported two cases of children, one dating back to 1933, whose brains had turned to mush. They both suffered from extremely rare genetic mutations that led to abnormally high levels of homocysteine in their bodies. So is it possible, he asked, that homocysteine could cause brain damage even in people without genetic defects? Well, now here we are in the 21st century, and homocysteine is considered a strong independent risk factor for the development of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Having a blood level over 14 may double our risk. In the Framingham study, they estimated that as many as 1 in 6 Alzheimer's cases may be attributable to this elevated homocysteine in the blood, now thought to play a role in brain damage, cognitive, and memory decline. Our body can detoxify homocysteine, though, using three vitamins: folate, vitamin B12, and vitamin B6. So why don't we put them to the test? No matter how many studies find an association between high homocysteine, cognitive decline, dementia, or Alzheimer's disease, a causal role, a cause-and-effect role, can only be confirmed by interventional studies. Now, initially, the results were disappointing. Vitamin supplementation did not seem to work. But the studies were tracking neuropsychological assessments, which are more subjective, compared to structural neuroimaging, actually seeing what's happening to the brain. And a double-blind, randomized, controlled trial found that homocysteine lowering by B vitamins can slow the rate of accelerated brain atrophy in people with mild cognitive impairment. As we age, our brain atrophies, slowly atrophies, but the shrinking is much accelerated in patients suffering from Alzheimer's disease. Kind of an intermittent rate of shrinkage is found in people with mild cognitive impairment, but so the thinking is maybe if we could slow down the rate of brain loss, we could slow down this conversion to Alzheimer's disease. So they tried giving people B vitamins for 2 years, and they found it markedly slowed the rate of brain shrinkage. The rate of atrophy in those with high homocysteine levels was cut in half. A simple, safe treatment can slow the accelerated rate of brain loss. A follow-up study went further by demonstrating that B vitamin treatment reduces by as much as sevenfold the brain atrophy in the region specifically vulnerable to Alzheimer's disease, to the disease process. Here's the amount of brain atrophy over 2 years in the placebo group. Here's the amount of loss in the B vitamin group. Less brain loss. Now, the beneficial effect of B vitamins was confined to those with high homocysteine, indicating a relative deficiency in one of those three vitamins. So wouldn't it be better to not get deficient in the first place? Most people get enough B12 and B6, but the reason these folks were stuck up at a homocysteine of 11 is that they probably weren't getting enough folate, which is found predominantly in beans and greens. 96% of Americans don't even make the minimum recommended amount of dark green leafy vegetables, the same pitiful number that don't eat the minimum recommendation for beans. In fact, if you put people on a healthy diet, on a plant-based diet, you can drop their homocysteine levels 20% in just 1 week, up from around 11 down to 9. The fact that they showed significant homocysteine lowering without any pills, without supplements, even at 1 week, suggests that multiple mechanisms may have been at work. They suggest it may be because of the fiber. Every gram of daily fiber consumption may increase folate levels in the blood nearly 2%, perhaps by boosting vitamin production in our colon by our friendly gut bacteria. It could also be from the decreased methionine intake. That's where homocysteine comes from. Homocysteine is a breakdown product of methionine, which comes mostly from animal protein. And so if you give someone bacon and eggs for breakfast, then a steak for dinner, you can get these spikes of homocysteine levels in the blood. Thus, decreased methionine intake on a plant-based diet may be another factor contributing to these lower, safer homocysteine levels. The irony, of course, is that those who eat plant-based diets long-term, not just at a health spa for a week, have terrible homocysteine levels. Meat eaters up at 11, but vegetarians are nearly 14, vegans at 16. Why? They're getting more fiber and folate, but they're not getting enough vitamin B12. Most vegans can be classified as being likely to suffer from hyperhomocysteinemia, too much homocysteine in the blood, because most vegans in this study were not supplementing with vitamin B12 or eating vitamin B12 fortified foods, which is critical for anyone eating a plant-based diet. But if you take vegans and give them B12, their homocysteine can drop down below 5. Why not just down to 11? Well, the reason the meat eaters were stuck up at 11 is probably because they weren't getting enough folate. But once vegans got enough B12, they could finally fully exploit the benefits of their plant-based diets and come out with the best levels of all.
Okay, well, there you have it. We have come towards the end of this week's show. I hope you learn some things. It's good to have a pencil and paper and write down these things because they're easy to forget. All right, so I think that's everything I can tell you until next week. I mean, if you want to, if you have time in the meantime, you can go on YouTube and you can find some of these things. A lot of these little clippets are taken from a site called Nutritional Facts. And it's he's an MD, and Dr. Michael Greger. And he spends a lot of time, he reads all the all the medical magazines that produced in the whole world on nutrition and health. So you're getting it from a very good source. And there are things like spirulina that people, you know, put a lot of faith in as a health product, and it turns out they have some risk factors and that people don't know about. So I go by the science of the program. I go by the science literature, basically, if there's any kind of dispute. And so I'd like to say so long for the moment. Hopefully I'll see you next Tuesday between 6:30 and 7:30, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3, and you can stream this radio station at freakradio.org, and then the image of the radio tower will come up, and you press the red button on the tower, and then you're connected to the show. All right, we'll go out with a little music now. This will be Nana Niskuri. Okay, see you next week.
Nadie comprende lo que sufro yo. Canto, pues ya no puedo sollozar. Sola, temblando de ansiedad estoy. Todos me miran y se van. Mujer, si puedes tú con Dios hablar, pregúntale si yo alguna vez te he dejado de adorar. Y al mar, espejo de mi corazón, las veces que me ha visto llorar la perfidia de tu amor. Te he buscado por doquiera que yo voy y no te puedo hallar. ¿Para qué quiero tus besos si tus labios no me quieren ya besar?
Estás.